Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is Canadian TV, summer camp, and The Good Place. How do you reconcile two communities that have been at odds for as long as any of us have been alive? My guest this week is Ross Murray, Senior Director of the GLAAD Media Institute and the Naming Project, as well as a Lutheran deacon. He felt from an early age that he was called to a life of service in the church and was lucky enough to live in a bubble where his sexuality and his faith weren't in conflict. And now he's doing what he can to make that a reality for others. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a quick reminder that I host twice monthly hangouts on YouTube where I chat with you about the books and movies and music and shows that you're obsessed with right now. The next one is on Saturday, April 27th at 9 a.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And by the way, I hope you'll join us for a new weekly Queer Dungeons & Dragons livestream every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific. Join me and Connor Olmsted, Brian Moreno, Justin St. Jen Vaughn, and my partner James as DM. You can watch us over at twitch.tv/prettyprettypixel. Big thanks to the supporters who make the Sewers of Paris possible. You can join them at patreon.com/mattbaum and check out some of the backer rewards. And for more queer podcasting, check out the show Queens of Adventure, starring drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons quest. That's at queensofadventure.com. Now, here's Ross.
Well, this week I'm speaking with Ross Murray, Senior Director of the GLAAD Media Institute, Founding Director of the Naming Project. Thanks so much for making time to chat with me.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The entertainment that changed my life. Here's what's weird. When I grew up in a very rural part of the country, northern Minnesota, on the border of Canada. Mm-hmm. And we only had Canadian television until I was in about the third or fourth grade. And so the stuff that shaped me was weirdly came from like CBC and the stuff that was being recreated, you know, and purpose for that, which is interesting because now as an adult, I've been watching Schitt's Creek on DVR from CBC, and watching these commercials actually like brings me back to my childhood for companies that I don't see in the United States and this weird kind of like crossover. So it's been one of those things I've sort of always realized. It's sort of like being shaped with a worldview that was not exactly American, but kind of American adjacent.
Okay.
And being the U.S. citizen and working here and sort of knowing the United States really well, but then kind of like having grown up with this exposure of a whole other country that I'm not a citizen of.
So what kind of depictions were like kind of washing over you from Canada?
So the sort of stuff that I was seeing was a lot of like, I was a kid, right? So a lot of it was like imagination sort of stuff. The shows that exist there were things like something called Mr. Dress Up, something called The Friendly Giant. There's a Canadian version of Sesame Street. Only instead of those segments that we see in Spanish here, the segments were in French, which again, as a child, it's kind of confusing. Like, oh, this is a whole other language. But recognizing that there's a lot of like imagination creating a whole world that can exist that, you know, is within the universe of what you want to see possible. I think like Mr. Rogers is a similar type thing like that, right? A whole created world of this is separate from the real life, but we have these characters, we have these folks that we've created. And I think like the puppets that existed on all these shows back in the, you know, early 80s, they were all puppets. I think really end up doing this odd sort of shaping of how, you know, how emotions come across when it's not humans that are expressing them.
Oh, that's a really interesting way to put it. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. Emotional tutorials through puppets. For me, it was like Fraggle Rock was very foundational.
Yes. Yeah. And realizing like, how do they, I now as an adult and I watch puppets and I love the Muppets, like the whole Jim Henson universe, I think is so great. Like how they can convey such nuance and such emotion, like when their eyes can't even close, or, you know, what they've realized they have to do with a puppet, with its face, with its ears, with its hands, to express joy or sadness, when, you know, really the face kind of looks the same, but you can do these things to it that just like suddenly says like, oh, this is angry. This is, you know, this is joyful. This is ashamed. And it's a way of doing expression that has to kind of combine both verbal, but also just be this like purely visual. Like when I go, that like means angry. That's like puppet angry right there. Is that kind of like growl to yourself thing.
Mm-hmm. And you said there was sort of it was giving you a sense of creating an imaginary world. And for a moment, I thought you just meant like Canada. Like there was this like parallel world of Canada out there. But you mean like really going into like I can't remember the one, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but that the kingdom, the imaginary kingdom that the trolley goes to. I can't remember
yeah,
what it's called.
It's a whole yeah, this whole other universe. And I know when people have watched like that Mr. Rogers documentary, I mean, there were rules about it too, right? Is like there was not crossover. Mr. Rogers didn't appear in that world, and the puppets didn't appear in his world, right? It was like this is make believe, this is imaginary, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and we explore all these feelings through it. But it also, like, here's what the real world is, and here's what the real world is like. And I think it's weird, like, as a kid, that these are things that I end up, like, playing. Like, I could imagine that, like, my daily life was being, like, a TV show, like a sitcom. And I would be playing outside, sort of imagining that there's some audience watching me, kind of like pre-Truman Show, maybe. And so kind of like, how do I camp this up? How do I play this up? What's the way that makes this look or sound or act like a youth sitcom? And it's weird that I would sort of think through that, like, oh, well, the school year's ending. That's the end of the season. Now tune back in the fall when I enter the fourth grade. I think it ended up sticking with me a lot, even as an adult who ends up being very stuck and grounded in what I'll call the real world, but also still always wanting to like articulate and help people to understand what the world could be like, right? Having that imagination of where I want us to be, even while I can acknowledge where we are right now.
So how did you feel about the real world as a kid? Were you like looking for an escape?
That's a good question. Maybe I, again, being from a really small town, growing up gay, not knowing any of the language around that, or being able to, you know, identify that way growing up, I know that I was different than what my hometown was. And I probably chalked it up less to being gay, but actually more to being academic or artsy or more churchy than all my friends too. And that's what I often saw as being the distinction between me and my peers. And I honestly, the older I got, the more I sort of affiliated or associated with friends that were not in my hometown and more like, oh, these are people that I met at summer camp. I like them and I consider them my friends in some cases more than the people that I was seeing every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about like the friend circle that you had. Like, what did they share your enthusiasm for like shows with puppets and imagination and stuff like that, or like what was popular when you were growing up?
I mean, yeah, the my friends, especially the camp friends, we sort of met through like a church-based fine arts camp, which basically was like a pastor had written a play/musical that had a really strong like moral, you know, something to it. And we would like get together and rehearse it. So it's not like we were like super professional or anything, but it was something that we did. And I think that overlap of like doing something like a play, like a musical, I thought they were good. They're probably a little schlocky, but that's fine. And being in this like church camp setting were really two kind of like foundational pieces that gave me a really strong sense of who I was. And how I was going to relate to the world. I'm a person, very religious person. I'm a Lutheran deacon. I've kind of followed that whole path of going to seminary and studying religion in college and sort of trying to live that out in my everyday life and in my calling vocation. And I think that was foundational. Like that camp experience, quite frankly, is what created that for me because I saw this wide network of people that were supportive, and we, you know, we generally enjoyed each other's company.
Well, so what was it about that experience, like finding supportive people? Like, how old were you, and what made you say, like, yeah, this is it, this is the life for me?
I was 14 the first time that I really feel like that sense of connection. We did this, you know, it was 1 week. It was high stress for a 14-year-old to put together this like musical in a week. And I think we banded together so well and realized that we were, you know, we were different, you know, we were different kind of folks from different towns and different communities. But I think because we sort of had this shared experience in a camp community, which was set apart and different than the rest of our lives, meant that we got to be more vulnerable with each other. We weren't going to see each other every day, so we might as well be more you know, more honest, more open, more vulnerable with each other.
What were you honest about?
It's funny, I didn't come out to any of them, at least not until like college. But I think in terms of talking about the struggle that I had with fitting in with my hometown, considering these people, telling them, you know, that I was somewhat of a misfit in my hometown, that I was connecting with them, enjoying being friends and getting together and having fun. That this is another like morality kind of thing, but like I wasn't a big partier or drinker in high school, and this group of peers generally wasn't either, at least not when we all got together. And so, again, I felt like I'm with this group that's not doing the peer pressure thing. And we're enjoying each other so much, but it's not being fueled the way that I was always seeing teen parties, either, you know, depicted in media or, frankly, you know, how I was seeing my peers act at my school.
Yeah, it sounds like you just weren't getting that pressure, or you weren't feeling the I don't know, the feeling of obligation that you had to be a certain way.
Yeah. I think there was more just like, and this is where I feel like acceptance. And it's funny, I didn't come out to them until I was older, like in college. But I think finding a group like that, that could accept me, becomes so foundational to me being able to be comfortable and accept myself and grow up and come out and, you know, kind of be the person that I am today, because I had a peer group that cared about me and let me know that they loved me for who I was, even before I had to necessarily even tell them everything about who I was.
Did you have like a sort of a shared culture? Because I know like sometimes when you come together, especially when you're 14, like when you come together with new people, it's difficult to, you know, get over the awkwardness of who are you and who am I and how do I fit in here? Like, did you have shared interests with them aside from, you know, you're all going to this camp, so you must have that membership in a faith community in common. But was there culture that you related to them through?
So it was less culture, and especially that first year, what happened was that there was a group of kids that came from a different state, and they were all from the same church. They signed up for this, but they had no clue that it was going to be that it was like, we're going to put a musical together in a week. And these kids like were not musical type people, right? So they're kind of going along, but realizing like, this is really scary. And then someone not from this group actually like halfway through the week quit, dropped out, and was kind of a, you know, a main character. And we had a little meeting with this pastor who wrote the play and was kind of running all this stuff of like, okay, we just lost someone in the middle of this week. You know, let's have a sit down. Like, do we want to just abandon this and you just have a normal week camp? Do you want to keep trying to do this? Like, what do you feel? And we did a lot of talking to each other. And those kids from the out of state, you know, who said, you know, I am so scared. I'm not a theater person. This is not what I was expecting. But we ultimately like did decide that we were going to go ahead and do this. And I feel like it was that experience that actually did make us even more bonded, that more so than like rallying around a certain type of culture, I guess. And I think if that kind of traumatic experience hadn't happened, we might frankly not have been as close. And it made it easier to go back year after year after year and then reconnect with the same people that were also coming back year after year after year.
When you came back to regular life after camp, did you feel like you were a different person?
Yeah, I feel this is the thing about camp. You feel like you're a different person, and you also realize how little the world around you has changed. You're changed, but the world kind of seems the same. And it's a bit of a, it's a hard fit. It's hard to figure out what to do with that, right? How do you keep this, like, I feel like this life and energy and spark, and then I'm going to go back and kind of face the same issues that I faced 2 weeks ago before I came here, right? And there, the Naming Project, which is a camp based because I had this great experience, we actually talk about it, right? And in churches, they talk about mountaintop experiences, and there's a whole Bible story that goes with it, right? Of like, you want that like high of endorphins that you have of having like just gone through this shared communal experience that is a struggle, but it's fun and you're bonding and you all love each other and it's great, but you can't stay in that moment forever. And eventually you do descend down the mountain and continue on with life, hopefully being able to be changed in a particular way that's going to, you know, help you navigate your world. But it doesn't mean that the problems or challenges or the way the world works necessarily changes. And so what you hope it does in the best circumstance is it helps you better navigate the way the world already is.
Well, what did that look like? How did you better navigate the world after you were like, oh, okay, I don't have to, you know, do all the stuff, all the teen stuff that people are expecting?
Well, and that's the hard part. It takes a while. It's a challenge. And I was for as weird and preppy as I am, I was an angsty teenager and kind of like ready to be angry at everyone and anyone. And not in a, it's weird. Like I was not a big rebellious person. I'm a pretty like straight-laced nerdy kind of guy. But like I just realized like I was so kind of mad that I wasn't in that mountaintop moment, right? I wasn't off with my real friends. I wasn't, and it took me a few years to figure out how to navigate and do that. And partly that's that feeling of being a misfit in my hometown and my school sticks with that a little bit. And probably was kind of a little bit with me through the rest of my high school experience. But it made leaving my high school and going into a new context, which at first for me was I was an exchange student, but then I was also at a community college, which was still in my hometown. But the community college experience was so wonderful, maybe because that's a different context. People don't try to fit you into boxes. People know there's different groups and that we're not all going to have to try to be the same thing. There's the cliques work in a very different way. And the way that it worked very well for me.
Well, so like you'd gone to the camp for a couple of years at that point, right? So you were sort of figuring yourself out. And was there a point where you were really committed and said like, you know, I think 14 seems like a really young age to, you know, commit to a life in the church. But was there a point where you're like, OK, nope, this is it. This is I'm on this trajectory.
You know, it started there. It probably frankly started earlier. Like we were churchy involved people and I like doing it. And I had a really good pastor growing up, who quite frankly, like, again, being an angry teenager involved being angry at him and he handled it quite well, and was able to kind of not put up with it and also be a really good, helpful, like resource and guide, which I give him a lot of credit for that. He probably also helped to kind of shape who I was. I was getting a lot of encouragement like, oh, you should be a pastor. You should be a pastor. You should be a pastor. And people would say that often. And
what did they
I think,
see in you that made people say that?
I don't know. Charisma. I would sometimes be asked to preach if there was like as like an older teenager or young adult, if there was a needed to fill in or something like that. I sort of have done some things like that. I also just was like super, I think the involvement was a part of it. And it was something that clearly I really liked. I liked being a part of that community. I liked being a part of that culture. That would include playing music for the church, singing in a church choir that was all mostly little ladies and then like me. Mm-hmm. And having those gifts nurtured in a really small congregation, small, really probably kind of conservative congregation, but really like, again, loving and affirming me as a person, which I've always loved. And I think that's part of what pointed me to like, well, I benefited from youth ministry and from camp. So why don't I go like study how to do that somewhere else?
Was there a point when you realized you were gay and did that cause some conflict?
I probably had less conflict with that than other folks have. Again, I think being in a church community that was affirming of me even before they knew that I was gay was helpful. My pastor was someone that I did tell that I was gay. He was one of the first like adults that I told. And handled it really well, especially for the time. And was accepting and also sort of said, okay, and now what? What do you want to do now? What's your, you know, keeping that sort of involvement within the church, handing over that that responsibility, helping to be more involved. And also, you know, if I was being an angry young man, like how to redirect that toward where the anger really was, which wasn't really, you know, at him or anyone else, just kind of like my situation. And I think he was someone that really, it's funny, I've seen him several times since then, and he early on, talked about church politics. And at the time, the denomination that I'm a part of, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, had a ban on clergy and same-sex relationships. And so he kind of said, like, I think you're really great. I know you have gifts for ministry. You should do this. I don't know if I ever see the church policy actually changing to allow you to do that. And
That seems pretty harsh for, well, I mean, not unrealistic, but just like a tough thing for a kid who's like, this is my calling to hear.
yeah, I mean, it is. I think it was hard for him to have to say to me too. One thing that's a little weird and nuanced, I guess, for me, is that I never really wanted to be a pastor. And I liked youth ministry. I liked working for institutions. I like kind of getting shit done, if I can say that as a deacon on the sewers of Paris. And in some ways, I thought, like, well, being a pastor is great, but I generally see pastors as people that are leading congregations, administering the sacraments, right, preaching on a daily basis. And I kind of want to do something else. And there are pastors that do the something else for sure. And so I was like, well, that's fine. Like, I kind of was okay with the church policy. I was like, I don't really want to be a pastor anyway, so I'm just going to go to youth ministry, right? There's not a ban on that. And
But still, to
so.
hear that, like, you must have felt like there was some level of rejection of who you were, right?
I think it was more of just an honest acknowledgement of where things were. I mean, he
Well,
did
not
what.
from him. I don't mean that he was rejecting you, but that the institution, the larger institution, saw something wrong with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that was definitely the issue. And again, it's the institution, right?
And that
And
wasn't a deal breaker.
no, because God's not the institution.
Ah, okay. So
And
they're higher authority, you might call them.
yeah. Is that? I mean, frankly, I say this a lot about religion, right? Like religion. People have to put in perspective what it actually is. It is human beings trying to make sense of God and the world around them and do something about it. But human beings are broken, sinful people, right? And even if we're trying to do the right thing, doesn't mean we're doing the right thing. And so we build, churches and denominations and religions, with some great intentions, but not always in terms of execution that's good. And this is one area that the church hadn't executed on very well.
What do you mean when you say broken sounds like a pretty harsh word, but I think that that might mean something other than just, it's just like a harsh critique of somebody. So what does that word actually mean?
Oh yeah, that's like a Christian-y phrase. It's a broken, sinful world, right? So like it's that kind of language. And I think a lot of queer people don't want to talk about sin because the accusation of sin has been so leveled against us, right? You are sinning because you're in a same-sex relationship. You are sinning because you do something, right? Lutherans actually approach this differently. And this is also why I'm still Lutheran, even after my childhood. It is an understanding that sin is not an action that we do. Sin is a state in which we live, right? It is a part of the fact that the world does not function the way it is supposed to. It is the fact that bad things are still happening, even when none of us really want those bad things to happen, right? That we do things that are against our and humanity's best interest, for convenience or for greed or for whatever, right? And that is the state of the world, which is why God's grace is not dependent on what it is we do. Because if it was up to us and our actions, there's no person that could actually achieve that. And I
Okay.
find that incredibly freeing. Because it means I don't have to act perfect. I've already got grace, which means I can do some good thing in the world, not to please God, but actually do something good in the world.
What you're describing actually sounds to me like humanism.
What's Lutheranism? I mean, and I think it's a different approach, right? Humanism's not going to have the God factor or have the grace factor. And grace is a big Lutheran concept, right? And that's kind of the fact that, like, God, loves us and forgives us and provides for us salvation, even if we're not going to earn it for ourselves. And originally it was sort of like a critique of the Roman Catholic Church of like, you had to do all these like, if you got to do enough good works, then you're gonna like have a high enough score to enter into heaven. Which is
Right,
why
the
right now
economy
I'm,
of the good place.
yes, well, which is why I love The Good Place, and this last season we can talk at length about that. But yeah, I think there's sort of been this idea, of that ledger, and the idea of grace actually breaks all of that apart completely. And says, no, this is actually completely God's action. And that I am going to trust that God is going to be a loving and saving God, which means I can do things in the world trying to do right and probably not doing them well enough or good enough or often enough, but still me just trying in the world is good and worth it and what I am called to do.
What does faith add to that? Like, why, what if somebody is just going along, they have that attitude of like, I should do good in the world. What does having faith in a higher power or in an organized religion, what does that change about doing that?
Like, why doesn't people just do good things because they want to do good things?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is and this is a bit of the I think this ultimately comes back to what does it might be motivation for some folks. For me, it is this idea, and this is what I do in the world is like my vocation. Like, what am I called to do in this world? And but then there's the who am I, which is the creation part of it. And part of my belief here is that, God created this world around me and created me as an individual and put me in this particular time and place and context, right? And so it's not just me in the world for myself because I'm doing what it is I want to do and what's making me feel good, which could be, helping an old lady across the street, or it could be slamming a six pack of beer, because those things make me feel good in different ways, right? It's also the idea that God put us into this network of the world around us, and that it's not me for myself. It is me being a part of a larger piece of creation, and that we all interact and have interwoven relationships and conversations, and in some cases, conflict. And so I always put like the creation question alongside of the vocation question.
Okay, so I think I see what you're saying, that there's sort of, and I see why I used the word that it was liberating, that you have an opportunity here, and you want to make the most of the opportunity.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I could sit around and do nothing, but I don't see purpose or value in that necessarily either. And I think that's one of the things that we need to like think about. It's weird, like sort of approaching like, there's like the what's good for me, there's the moral what's good for the world, there's the, what do people expect me to do? And I think we need some system. Everyone needs some value system to help them sort out answers to those questions. And religion is one of the ways in which people approach it to be able to do it. It's not the only way, I don't think. I think that, that the people come up with ethical systems even outside of religion. But I think we're always going to have these kind of questions of like, who am I and how do I relate to the rest of the world?
Were you able to find role models of LGBTQ people of faith?
Not until I moved, grew up and moved out of my small town to Minneapolis, and kind of
What
saw
got you
more
to
of them
move there?
there. After my community college stint, I went to college there,
Okay. What were you studying?
youth and family ministry.
Okay. How did you find, like, going small town to Minneapolis, which is, the biggest city in the world, but it's still, like, a pretty metropolitan by, for a Midwest city. So
Yeah.
what was that experience like? Did you feel like a culture shock getting there?
No, it wasn't bad for me. So one thing that happened after high school, I was an exchange student and I lived in Brussels, and that was my big city experiment. Like this, I lived in this little town, Little Fork. Doesn't that sound like a small town name?
It
Little
does.
Fork. And when I graduated, I was an exchange student and got placed in Brussels. And I sort of told people that, I say I'm a big city person, but this is actually my first real time to like test out whether I am. And if I'm not, it's a year and I'll come home and I'll, live a small town life. But if this is good and this feels right, then this is probably like where I'm supposed to be. So that made moving to Minneapolis easier. I feel like after the culture shock of moving to a place where I didn't speak the language and everything, going to Minneapolis was relatively easy. And I went to a private Lutheran school, so again, I'm around a chapel, I'm around ostensibly Lutheran students, I'm still in that faith community, only run through like a campus ministry as opposed to, a home congregation or a church camp.
Did you start finding gay community, like either in Europe or when you moved to Minneapolis?
Yeah, when I moved to Minneapolis, and this is one thing I realized for tension is that I was a part of like the LGBT student organization, and I was a very active person in campus ministry. And for me, these things had sort of been like pretty easily reconciled to me. Like it, there was not like this. I know people talk about like these, warring factions or whatever within themselves. I never really had that. And I actually had the advisor, a faculty member who was the advisor for the LGBT student organization, tell me that I was an anomaly and that other students really didn't understand how I could have both my faith and my sexual orientation so well integrated. And that was a surprise to me. Like, huh, really? Other people don't get it the way that I do? Like, I can't, this is part of the privilege I came from, right? I was in a place that largely was pretty well accepting, and there hadn't been a problem. I did after college because I was so confident. And I just kind of told people like, oh, it's my own natural charm and charisma, and I can, win people over if I just tell them who I am and whatnot. I joined this traveling music ministry team afterward, and that experience did not go like my college experience, right? I ran into other folks that really could not handle me being openly gay and calling myself, Christian and being very active in churchy stuff, and they tried to make it work for a while, but eventually I did get kicked out of that organization. So that also let me know, like, oh, it's not always like roses and sunshine and high fives from Jesus.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can have that confidence in your faith, but that doesn't mean that it'll translate to people around you who have their own ideas about like what supposed to, what the supposed to of the world is, like what things are supposed to be like.
Right. And that was, I mean, in terms of like why I'm even here doing what I'm doing with GLAAD and the naming project and everything else, I really have to go back to that experience. Because before that, I was sort of like, you know what? I can, this goes back to your question about like feeling rejection from the church writ large. Like, oh, well, before this, like, I just won't make waves and I'll be like this quiet little youth ministry person and be alone, why not? And I kind of do all that. And then this experience and falling in love, quite frankly, both of those things like upended my worldview of what I thought I was going to be able to do, and recognize that even with all the support and privilege that I had, I couldn't navigate this, which means other folks are going to have a harder time doing that than me. And I know people have had way worse experiences than I ever had, being kicked out of that organization, but that did let me know, like, okay, I want to do something, and I want to make sure that other people don't have this like faith-based rejection that I just had, because that was crappy theology and a crappy experience. And that's why I do like religion, LGBTQ advocacy.
Well, it sounds like sort of counterintuitively, being rejected by a faith-based organization pushed you, or at least affirmed your place among people of faith.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is kind of the critical point, right? When this happened, this is a great point to say, the church sucks, Christianity sucks, God sucks. I'm going to walk away from it, right? Like, if someone's going to drop out, that's like the best, most convenient place to do it, right? And I think part of what happened, like when it happened, I did really have to question, like, is my problem with God? And I did pretty quickly come to the conclusion, like, my problem still is not with God, right? These were people that did this. These were people that actually had the problem and were projecting their own issues and insecurities onto me. And at the same time, going back to finding those role models, some of the LGBTQ Lutherans heard about what happened to me in the organization. They, talked to me about, do you want us to make a big stink about this? Do you want us to do something? And eventually I started getting involved with an organization that was helping to make the Lutheran Church more officially, through policy, inclusive to LGBTQ people. And getting involved in a local chapter and then like the national board, and eventually working for the national board. So like, this is the like, okay, this policy really is a problem that bars clergy and in same-gender relationships. And so we have to systematically work to change it, and we have to make the denomination want to change it, not just force it on it, but have it be a choice that we make as a church.
That must have seemed like a pretty huge undertaking to steer course correct a very large ship.
Yeah, but this process had been happening even before I got involved. So just for background, my denomination, the ELCA, it's a semi-democratic thing. We have assemblies. Then it was every 3 years. Now it's now I think it's four. So they would have assemblies every couple of years. And, you know, they would have delegates from around that would be doing voting like this, right? So, and it had come up. In fact, my pastor had updated me on a couple times where it had come up at some of these churchwide assemblies, you know, and how much conversation it had. And he's like, well, I didn't think we'd ever have this conversation. And then this organization that I was involved with, which was called Lutherans Concerned North America, not a great name, but they've changed it since then. It was really working on how do we make congregations more welcoming? And if we can make congregations more welcoming, that will make it easier for the denomination to become more welcoming. And by the time I was involved, the church had actually implemented, they're going to do like a 4-year study process and maybe make some decisions at the end of that. Now, 4 years stretched into 8, so nothing goes quickly here. But at the end of those 8, we did make some really significant policy change decisions.
That's pretty remarkable. That must have been a really... a big moment for you, like a kind of years of work coming to fruition.
Yeah. I mean, this is in terms of like highlights of professional career, being involved with that organization at, you know, the moment of this vote. And the vote was there was kind of a series of votes. And one part of it was to accept a social statement, like a teaching statement on human sexuality that was not great, but it was good. And it left room for LGBTQ people to be a part of the denomination. And then after that was accepted to start to change our policy that would, this is the language they use. This is 2009. So it's like pre-marriage equality being like a real thing in most people's minds. So they wouldn't use the word marriage, but they said, we will find ways to recognize publicly accountable, lifelong, monogamous, same gender relationships.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot of qualifiers.
Yes. So we call them palms.
Okay.
And then we will find ways to allow clergy who are in such relationships. And those things all passed, which began a process of, you know, re-rostering some clergy that had been defrocked after they, you know, came out or got partnered up or people that got kicked out of the candidacy process, and then changing their candidacy to start to allow folks, which is, I didn't become a deacon until after all of that. In fact, it was a few years even after that. Like, this is something, again, I sort of just accepted the church policy and like, I can do a lot of good work without having to like jump through these hoops that clearly are not designed to let me be through them, which has been true. But now I've sort of like, okay, if I can have a relationship with the church, this is one way in which I can do it. But those votes are significant. And it was high drama. There was a tornado the day of the vote right outside of the assembly hall, which there are some bad theologians that would like to say that's like God warning us. Although what I say, because I was in a different space, was that the tornado actually came before the vote happened, which is our anxiety. And when the vote took, that's when the sun came out, which is accurate because I was outside when it was happening. And so sort of watching this kind of like high drama unfold and realizing that there is a way forward for this denomination that is still not perfect, but is making steps to try to do better.
How much of your work is spent interacting with skepticism, either from Lutherans who are skeptical about queer people in the church or from queer people who are skeptical that faith could be welcoming to them?
No, that still absolutely exists. Lutherans, here's what's interesting. After that vote, which was now 10 years ago, if Lutherans didn't like queer people in congregations and denominations, they left. The way that we the way that we worded all these policies actually still allows space for them to be here. Like, you could still be anti-LGBTQ and still be a full-fledged member of the denomination, but they read that, well, if this other group's going to be here, then we like must be forced out. So they walked away and they left. And in some ways, they tried to form their own little like break-off groups, right? Which has left the Lutheran Church, the ELCA that I'm a part of now, really open and welcoming, because the rabble-rousers and naysayers have either been converted over the course of the last 10 years that the sky didn't fall in like they were scared it was going to, or they went off and made their own little church networks. And that's allowed the denomination to be way freer to speak out on social issues that relate to LGBTQ people and probably a host of other issues that the church should be speaking out on, but was held back because it was so scared of offending some section of their membership.
So it seems like there was I was going to use the word purge, but I don't think that's the right word. It's sort of a choice to, for folks to say, nope, this is beyond the pale, so we're going to go off and do our own thing, which leaves everyone, I guess, as a sort of self-selecting group of tolerance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, like people sort of exist on this like spectrum of acceptance, right? And I teach this a lot at GLAAD. We sort of talk so much about like movable middle and they move, right? And we've got our ally base and the opposition. But quite frankly, the spectrum's more nuanced than that. And we would kind of operate on this scale that went from punitive rejection to toler to sorry, punitive re okay, I'm gonna start again. We would operate on this scale of acceptance that would start with punitive rejection, right? I'm going to punish you and kick you out, to silence. We're just not going to say anything at all, to tolerance, to acceptance, and ultimately to advocacy. And I think about that scale in my head, to realize that if you can get someone to move from actively persecuting and punishing you to just shutting up, that's a win. But you also don't want, but you don't want people to stay in silence either, right? But you can't like leapfrog past these phases. They kind of have to go through them all. And so part of it is figuring out where people are. And most people are in that like, you know, silence tolerance kind of area. And I feel like we've done some shifting, even for people that would have been resistors before, after having seen and experienced the, you know, watching the faithful ministry of queer clergy, of seeing young people and families come out and join their congregations. I think in some ways, a lot of their fears and the things that they've been told about us weren't true. And now they're seeing the reality of our lives because folks aren't hiding the way that they were before. And allowing them to go through a process that can start to see and understand that, again, God didn't just create them. God created a whole wide, huge world around them. And they get to interact with the rest of that huge, wide world. And you know, in some ways, I hate shoulds, but they should interact with the big, wide world, not just go and hide off in their own little bubble.
How do you persuade, maybe persuade isn't the right word, but how do you make the case to queer people that, I don't know, that faith is something that they could, that is understandable? I mean, I guess basically the question is, how do you make it friendly?
Yeah, well, I will say, like, so if I like, you know, upfront just tell people I'm a deacon, or I tell people I used to like kind of joke like I work for the church, even if I'd work for GLAAD doing religion, I just say like I work for the church. And the reactions that you get are really interesting. One, I mean, the biggest rule that happens if you're a clergy or say you work for the church, people stop swearing around you. And they also will usually start telling you what their opinion is of religion or what their background or history is with religion, right? I don't spend a lot of time trying to convince people that you know, church is okay, like give it a try. I would rather do that by stating what it's done for me or what it is that I'm doing, and let them sort of come to that conclusion themselves. 'Cause I feel like if I tell you like, shame on you, Matt, you should be going to church, like I don't feel like that's going to be motivating for you at all.
Probably not.
But if I, the tone of your voice implies it probably, yeah, that is really
Yeah.
not. But I think, I mean, if I can talk really honestly about both the struggles and the joys and what it is I'm doing in the world, because of this calling that I feel like I have, I feel like that's way more authentic. And if someone is interested, if there is that spark of, well, you know, I haven't gone to a church since I was 16. Maybe I want to go back to one. Like, people come back to me and say things like, could you recommend a place I could go in Las Vegas or Seattle or Minneapolis or whatever? And so, you know, it's not me that's like converting or evangelizing or things. Like, as a Christian, again, like I sort of say, like, it's not me that's going to do it. It's the Holy Spirit, right? I'm just going to try to be like a very authentic witness. And then people are going to hear that and they're going to do whatever they're going to do with it, right? Maybe be like intellectually interested. Rarely does anyone want to fight with me. I hardly ever hear someone tell me like, shame on you for being a Christian. I mean, the only time I ever hear that is like social media where people just like to scream at strangers anyway. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't happen in any time that I've basically shared any of the stories that I've shared with you so far.
Well, something that we touched on a little bit earlier was The Good Place. And the reason I'm thinking about it now is because, you know, we're kind of talking about like talking about faith without evangelizing about, or I guess, belief systems or morality systems. And that's such a good show for explaining, I guess, the philosophy of right and wrong without really assigning a school of thought to it. Just it's sort of a sampler platter. So it sounds like that's something that that you've been enthusiastic about as well, that show.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, and I love, they've been up, and I've written about it before too, a couple articles, but they've been really upfront, right, to say like, we are not going to prescribe this to a particular religion, right? Which gives them the freedom to kind of explore everything, which I think is cool. In this last season, spoilers ahead for all you listeners, I feel like they've really turned, like, I picked up a lot of Lutheran theology in this last season, season three. And again, maybe I heard it because this is what I've studied and I like am attuned to hear stuff, and that someone else wouldn't have picked it out that way. But there were a couple episodes that particularly stood out to me. And one really was the point where the characters knew they were condemned, right? They had already been through hell once. They were back on earth to try this experiment. But now that they know that it's an experiment, there's a point total. And they say this, now that you know what the system is, every action you do is corrupted because your motivation is to earn points rather than to do the good thing in the world, right? And this is, even if you're going to do good things, your motivation is the wrong motivation, so it's going to count against you. And they spend the episode, all these characters, in a variety of different ways dealing with that. There's the broken, sinful world thing that I just described, right? Even if you're doing good stuff, it's still corrupted in some way. And they ultimately land at the end of, well, you know what? If we're already condemned, then why don't we just try to do some good thing in the world? And maybe that's going to help somebody else. It's that sacrificial, like, I'm already gone, so why don't, like, why can't I just like help other people avoid the trauma or the trouble or the experiences that I've had? And I love that episode. And then the other place that this shows up, you know, really was when they start exploring the point totals of everything's so complicated in our world today that even when you do simple acts, you inadvertently, you know, harm yourself. And they, you know, buying a tomato makes you lose points because there's pesticides and exploited labor and sort of doing this explanation of everything is complicated and there is no, you know, empirically like one good action and one bad action because everything we do has ripple effects and draws on a line of things that have happened before our action and has impact on what's happening after our action too. And I think those are the two kind of episodes that really resonated with me. I started trying to like find clips of all of them to save because I think they're really, they looked at the world in a very similar way that I have studied and that I've grown up. And so I like latched onto those as a Lutheran.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's sort of, I mean, that's something that is invisible to me because I'm not knowledgeable enough about different schools of thought. But it's interesting that there's something sort of either coded in there that is intentionally a reference or that, you know, someone independently arrived at a system of belief to present in the show.
Well, and here's what I think is the genius thing now that you've said that, right? If I sat you down and said, let me give you a lecture on Lutheran ethics, Again, I don't think you'd be all that excited about that. But what we have here is a show that actually presents some of this stuff, never talks about it as a lecture, which is what, this entire show has done. Like, let's take philosophy, and explore these moral and philosophical questions with, with funny characters and fart humor and everything else, which means you are picking up on this stuff. And what I've loved this season, they've been putting the NBC's been putting out some. They did these interviews with Todd May, who is a philosophy professor at Claremont University, and he's the consultant on the show, which means he is giving mini 5-minute lectures on philosophical themes. And then they're using the clips from the show to basically say how they took these themes and played them out in a script. And so, again, as a nerd, I love that because I'm getting the lecture and I'm getting the humor. But the show is also sneaky in that you're picking up and learning philosophy, even if you don't want to learn it, right? It's just getting presented in front of you, and it's influencing your worldview in some particular way.
Yeah, I guess one way to look at it is initially I thought like, oh, haha, isn't this clever? It's tricking people into it being interested in philosophy and theology. But I don't know that it's a trick so much as like, it's just revealing like, this stuff is actually kind of fun to think about.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, I think most people, and I'm like this too, right? Philosophy does not sound fun or exciting or the thing that I want to spend a ton of time doing. And I think the ways that it gets presented, the real philosophy, and especially moral philosophy, is this is supposed to have some sort of impact on our world. This is not just answering questions of, like, where our feet don't touch the ground and we're just in a headspace so much that it has no impact on life. I'm interested in a theology and in a philosophy that is going to mean something and make a tangible difference. So when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door in Wittenberg, he was answering some very practical, pragmatic questions that were impacting and influencing the people in his parish, and how some of the practices of the church were exploiting people, and what kind of things should fix it. And then all this, like, theology, like, kind of backfills that because it helps to answer these questions, right? The same thing has happened in Central America with liberation theology, which, talks about the fact that the poor and the exploited should be free, and that if God is going to have a preference for in the world, God's going to have a preference for those who are poor and marginalized and exploited, and gives people some sense of worth. Otherwise, they can just be seen as cogs in a system that, end up being owned and controlled by other people. And so good philosophy and good theology should have real-world impact and often comes out of real-world situations.
So what do you see is your work now? Like you've made some significant changes to the way that the church organization works, and you're doing a lot of work with GLAAD. So what is your like, I guess your, what are you called, like what impact on the world are you called to have these days?
Yeah, I am still. So the Naming Project Camp has been going on for 15 years now, and this has been a group of young people, LGBTQ youth, having that camp experience like I had as a kid. That's my, like, direct service, pastoral care, setting where I can, where young people can figure out who they are, how they relate to the God, how they relate to the rest of the world, and kind of give that week away to help navigate the world outside. We talk a lot about that, and I think there's ongoing call for that. I also think, especially after having changed the church, worked with changing the church policy, I've been more interested on what role the church, and by the church, I really should be saying, like, religion, all religions, what sort of impact they're going to have on the wider world. And I think that our culture and our society and our world need to change. And I want my church to be a leader in that. I want all religions to be a leader in that. And sometimes they've not been. So oftentimes they've been stragglers. But once they're in a place where they're kind of settled and answered some of these questions for themselves internally, like my denomination did, then it's time to turn outward, right? And how do we start to influence and impact culture? And that's partly why I'm at GLAAD right now, is GLAAD is about culture. And it is about how people think and feel about LGBTQ people, what kind of good or bad things they want to see happen, for people's lives, what emotions they have when they think about their interactions with LGBTQ people. And these are not legal or political questions. To me, these are still values questions. And I think our culture helps to shape some of those values. And that's why I think my work at GLAAD is really powerful, because I'm both very like pragmatic, right? What can I get done? But it gets informed by this overarching value of, I want people to have human dignity, not just from me, but from everyone. And our society needs to be taught how to do that.
Yeah, have some, like, giving everybody the basic human dignity. I mean, that sounds like a pretty good sort of like baseline for something to want for everyone in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if we can figure out that, and again, maybe that language is different from group to group to group, but I think that's a great values term, right? In fact, like human dignity is a very Catholic term. And part of it is holding up these values that cultures or denominations or societies purport to have, and say, if you really want to live out these values in a real way, here's what you need to do, or here's how these values relate to LGBTQ people. And I think that's been the distinction, right? Like there's religious values and there's LGBTQ acceptance. And there's that like tension between the two. But the reality is that LGBTQ people help denominations and churches and society live out the values that we say that we hold. And I think that's important.
So if people want to see your work and connect with you online, where should they go?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter at InLayTerms. That's I'm not clergy, but I'm proud of as a layperson, InLayTerms. Mm-hmm. That's Twitter and Instagram. Also, I encourage people to check out the Naming Project. It is thenamingproject.org. I run that with some other volunteers, and it's a beautiful passion project. And I mentioned this earlier, but I am working on a spiritual app startup that's letting me share some reflections about life and the world and how we function. And that should be launching in a few weeks and months, called Venly. And I'm kind of excited to see how that goes. And people can hear my musings on whatever's happening in the world.
Cool. Well, Ross, thanks again so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again to Ross for joining me. My recommendation this week is to check out a show we talked a little about, The Good Place. It is not, as I initially thought, a spin-off from The Good Wife. It is, in fact, a sitcom, and the premise is maybe a little bit tropey, that the afterlife is just another form of bureaucracy to navigate. But on this show, goodness turns out to be surprisingly not as good as one might wish, and it treads a tightrope of being both smart and funny and having a lot of heart. The characters on the show care for each other, often in spite of their own instincts, and it may possibly have the best pansexual character ever to appear on television. Thanks again for listening, and remember, we've got some upcoming live streams. There's Dungeons & Dragons Adventures every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific. That's at twitch.tv/prettyprettypixel. And we have Laid Back Chit Chats twice a month. The next one of those is on Saturday, April 27th at 9 a.m. There's a link to that at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. For more queer podcasting, check out Queens of Adventure, featuring drag queens on a Dungeons & Dragons quest. That's at queensofadventure.com. And as always, huge thanks to all the supporters who make the Sewers of Paris possible. You can join them over at patreon.com/mattbaum. Please reach out and let me know what you think of the show on Twitter and Facebook, or sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.